Welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. I'm Brandi Cruz. Wonderful to be back with you for a full week of live episodes. Coming up today, I'm going to throw my support behind a referendum to repeal Senate Bill 5599, a bill we talked a lot about during the legislative session, up to the point it was signed into law by the governor. And it has to do with kids being able to run away to a shelter, say protected health care, and then be hidden from their parents. More 2024 hopefuls have emerged. I'm curious whether there's even a taste for them or whether this is just a result of like campaign consultants convincing people they should be the next president and then trying to make a bunch of money. Also later on, cocaine principles. We talked about your kids getting weird sex ed lessons in school. Well, how would you feel if your kid's principal is just doing cocaine? Weird stuff. Before we get to all of that, I have to alert you guys to a little incident. Nicole got into a fight over the weekend against a softball, and she lost. Now, it's very obvious, okay? So first, let me show you this. So let me just give a little background. So I'm with our friend, our mutual friend, Jessamine, and we're up in Snohomish County for a wedding expo. Nicole's supposed to meet us, and she had a softball game, and suddenly she sends us a text, and she says, hey, I had an incident on the field, and I probably should go home and ice my face. And I'm like, incident on the field? So she starts sending us images. And I'm like, oh, that's not an incident. You should call 911. So anyway, the first image she sends us, like, all bloodied up, right? And then as the hours go by, this thing just gets worse and worse, and it turns into just, like, this giant ball on the side of her face, and it's all black and blue. I mean, luckily it didn't hit her nose or her eye. She didn't break any bones, but her face is all screwed up. So, Nicole, I told you, she's going to wear her sunglasses.
It's so embarrassing. I can't even move half my mouth. I'm so embarrassed.
I told you, you can talk as little or as much as you want. Right. You can be on camera, but you've got your cool sunglasses on.
Got my big sunglasses.
Oh, my gosh. It really is so bad. And you didn't feel like you had to go get that thing stitched up, eh?
Well, I don't think they would stitch it at this point. It's so swollen that it's like, I don't know. I'm giving it a little bit of time. But no, it's not showing any meat or anything. It's just kind of, it stopped bleeding pretty quickly. So I think that it'll, as it goes down in swelling, it'll heal itself, I'm hoping.
She said, hey, I can't come in.
If you're a medical professional, tell me if I should do something different. But
she told me she couldn't come in today. I said, you have to.
Oh, that's not true. No, you said you want to do the show? I said, of course I'm doing the show. It's a black eye. I've actually never had a black eye, though. Never.
Well, this one's quite a doozy. Yeah. So we just, you know, full disclosure, she might wear the sunglasses for a few days.
Yeah.
I didn't hit her.
It's for your sake. You don't have to look at it.
It was a softball.
So
there are witnesses, okay? It wasn't me. But anyway, Nicole, I hope your face gets better.
Thank you.
I'm glad it didn't happen before my wedding, because I would have said, you're not a bridesmaid anymore.
I said out after, you know, 20 years of doing radio, I never get hit in the face. And then a couple months into being on camera every day, of course, I've gotten hit in the face.
It's rough, man. It looks rough in person. I'm just going to be honest. Anyway. So that's what's going on with Nicole. She's like, I can't believe I'm showing people these pictures. They're mortifying. All right. I think we're all united in our hope that your face gets better.
Thank you.
Yes. Okay. Let's get to our top story of the day. I spoke to the Kitsap County Lincoln Day Dinner, which is the annual dinner held by each county's Republican Party. I was there on Friday, and in the lobby, folks were collecting signatures for Referendum 101. Immediately signed it. I asked them for extra papers so I could get people to fill it out. So this is the referendum we were expecting to give voters an opportunity to weigh in on Senate Bill 5599. And to me, this is a no-brainer. You know, I don't know what the appetite will be of Washington voters to repeal 5599, but to me, this is really about parental rights. It's not about transgender issues and transgender youth. If you haven't been watching the podcast, 5599 is a bill that allows a child of any age to show up at a shelter or say, I'm here because I want to seek protected health care, or be it types of gender care or abortion, and maybe they had a disagreement with their parents over it, and the shelter is not allowed to tell the parents where their child is. And that's insane to me. That's just going way too far. Do I believe the bill was probably well-intended to help kids that are going through a difficult time? Sure. But you can't just strip parents of their right to know where their kids are. You just can't do that. So I am officially endorsing Referendum 101, and I am urging you to do your part to get enough signatures collected by the deadline. So the deadline is July 15th. The goal is obviously to have signatures turned in a little bit before that so they can make sure, hey, do we have enough? You can go to reject5599.com. Again, that's reject5599.com. You can, they need 200,000 signatures by July 15th. You can share that link with individuals. You can contribute to the signature gathering efforts. You can also find out how to return signed petition sheets. So this is an empty one. I'm not showing anyone's information, but this is what the petition sheets look like. So you can figure out how to get your hands on these. I picked up a couple extra copies as well. Here is the other call to action element that I want from you guys. I think I'm going to have some meet and greets across Western Washington just to meet folks, talk to folks about politics, but also have these available there for you to sign if you would like to sign. You certainly don't have to, but if you are interested. So I need a couple business owners to reach out to us. If you've got, let's say, a brewery, a coffee shop, somewhere where we can gather, I can have a little meet and greet and we can have these available. So if you're interested in doing that and you're in Western Washington, reach out to us. Just go to undividedpod.com, and you'll find a little contact form and just say, yeah, I think I have a good meeting place where you can do a meet and greet, and I'll come. It'd be great for business too, you know. Well, maybe a place where we can have a beer, chat about government and politics, because this is really one where I want to put whatever influence and effort I have behind to get enough signatures to just give voters a choice. At the end of the day, that's all I want. I just don't think that this was something that politicians should have done, taking rights away from parents. And if at the end of the day, the voters of Washington want to keep $55.99, fine. But I think that they ought to have a choice. So I'm going to talk more about that at the end of the show. But I just wanted you guys to know that this referendum is now available for you to sign. R101, you can go to reject5599.com. It's complete government overreach. It should be a bipartisan effort to get this thing repealed, because it's not about political party. It's not about ideology. It's about just respecting the rights of parents to know what's going on with their kids at the very basic level. So something to think about. And if you have any questions about it, by the way, feel free to ask me and I can explain it as best I can. Okay, there was a great story from our friend Jonathan Cho. I really think we need to play a Jonathan Cho story every single week just to elevate what he's doing, because, man, he's doing independent journalism for fixhomelessness.org. He's a senior fellow with Discovery Institute covering homelessness, and he's just in the weeds. In the gutter, on the street, doing homeless coverage, and it's awesome. So we have been talking about for some time now this back and forth with a homeless camp in downtown Burien, which is in King County, right? And so it's a sort of difficult dance. And some in the city of Burien, some business owners have gotten so fed up with where a homeless camp is that they're like, we're going to go in and clear this thing ourselves. And Dow Constantine basically warned them, don't do it, the King County executive, saying that it would violate a federal court ruling out of Idaho. And they were like, you know what? Screw this guy. We're going to do it anyway. Here's the report from our friend Jonathan Cho.
Thursday morning, King County Executive Dow Constantine followed through on his threat and blocked sheriff's deputies from assisting Deborah George.
I think it's a very bully, cowardly move.
She's the director of Burien Cares.
Encampments don't work.
This local nonprofit leased the land from the city and is planning to turn it back into a dog park.
It's the right thing to do.
And George was able to clear this homeless encampment in the center of downtown without the help of the county.
So you're left to do this on your own?
I am left to do this with incredible, amazing people around me.
Last month, Constantine fired off this aggressive letter saying any encampment removal would be in violation of the landmark Martin versus Boise decision if the people living on the streets were not offered a place to go.
Burien has been the dumping ground.
But Martin Barrett.
We don't necessarily have to bow to Dow Constantine.
No relation to this case.
They want to strong-arm cities like Burien.
Says Constantine is misinterpreting the law.
So the idea that because we didn't have beds for them in Burien, therefore we could not sweep, is completely bogus.
Barrett is the publisher of the Burien News and says this is the key.
That option does not need to be in your city. That option has to be somewhere regionally.
been working alongside these guys for quite some time.
Volunteers like Christine Moreland and Joseph Riverson say the homeless were indeed offered a place to go before the sweep.
Just to be clear, are you saying 43 people lived here?
Yes, sir.
Moreland and Riverson were even willing to drive them to shelters and detox centers outside of Burien, since most of the ones here are only for cold weather or women and children.
You know, I don't really know all the politics behind it.
But they say most of the campers refused.
Right now, the talk is that they're going to go to different parts of the city.
Quite frankly,
even the Burien City Council agreed Constantine's letter had zero legal standing.
You didn't appreciate Dow Constantine's letter.
Well, when I read it, I got to tell you, I wasn't happy about it, right?
And Mayor Sophia Aragon felt it fractured the relationship between the city and the county.
I'm also very disappointed that it set a tone to really weaken our collaboration.
Martin says it's time for other communities to look at the precedent set here in Burien and start pushing back.
Hopefully it's going to encourage a number of other cities.
If Constantine tries to do this again.
We're not buying into the threats of King County. We can stand up to them. And we're going to move forward with what's best for our city.
And again, that's from our friend Jonathan Cho over at fixhomelessness.org. Go check out his work. Follow him at Cho Show on Twitter. Now, after this sweep happened, and look, I get it with the concern about certain types of sweeps where it's like, you're just pushing them from place to place and you're not really solving the problem. But what do you do when they reject help? What do you do when you offer help over and over and they say no? To me, I think sweeping them from place to place is a way to say, hey, this isn't acceptable here. We're not going to allow you to get comfortable in these encampments when we've offered you help, when we've offered you services. So in that case, I think sweeps are fine. Now, unfortunately, what happened over the weekend in Burien is that a lot of them moved to Dottie Harper Park, and there's like a playground there for kids. So it's like, oh my gosh. So now they're around kids and now there's parents who are like, hey, now this homeless camp is at a park where our kids play. But I just find it fascinating that Dow Constantine, who has no control over that area, I mean, he's the executive for unincorporated parts of the county, not for a city. So that's why I was glad for you to hear the mayor say, like, I saw the letter. I'm like, who are you basically to tell us what to do? And so I'm glad some of these cities are being like, we don't care if the executive won't let the sheriff's deputies help us. We're going to do this ourselves. And I think more cities need to do that and to send a message that we don't like the way that the Uber progressives are trying to deal with the homelessness issue. And it's ruining our cities. So great reporting, per the usual, from Jonathan Cho. We'll continue to follow that situation in Burien. On yesterday's Sundays with subscribers, we had a lengthy interview with Semi Byrd, who is a candidate to be the next governor of Washington. He's a Republican. He's a relative unknown besides his position on the Richland School Board. I got to say, I really enjoyed our conversation. It's up exclusively for subscribers right now. Although when it comes to candidate interviews, I know some people on social media were like, how can you put a candidate interview behind a paywall? We don't. We give them early access to candidate interviews. And then if it's specifically someone running an active political campaign, we will post it separately because that's the fair thing to do. But I wanted to play a clip from it today because we had, you know, an interesting conversation about the reality of it being very difficult to win as a Republican in Washington State. Our voters haven't elected a Republican governor for like almost 40 years. But also about the fact that Semi Byrd is Black, which is an interesting, I guess, you have a white guy running on the Democratic side, and they're so identity obsessed, and then you have a Black Republican. And I asked him whether he thinks that would factor into the race or not. So here's a clip from our interview with Semi Byrd on Sundays with subscribers. Do you feel like the mainstream Republicans have already decided that's our guy?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, without hesitation. And that's okay, mm-hmm. because one of the things we find when we do intelligence analysis, these are normed behaviors. I'm a behavioral scientist, and so I see this. We have normed behaviors in terms of politics in Washington State, such as if you can get this backing or this establishment support, that is going to be the candidate that wins. Well, I believe that Lauren Culp showed that that wasn't necessarily the case. And this is not me advocating for any candidate, but simply doing my analysis, as I told you. I did Bill Bryant. I did, again, Dino. I did, you know, Rob McKenna and... Yeah.
Well, Lauren Culp lost by 500,000 votes.
Exactly. And that's it. So when you look at all the different candidates and their campaigns and how they performed in each county, that was my analysis. And so when they come up short like that specific to Lauren Culp, I can also say that Bill Bryant got 500,000 more votes in King County than Lauren did
right.
in King County when he won. I did the complete analysis. And so we stop and say, well, what was missing? What didn't happen? And that goes back to valuing all of the voices in the community, not just the political pundits, not just the people in the Republican Party, but all voters. Because if you're a governor, you represent all people.
Yeah, and I'm interested to dive into how you plan to learn from that to strategize in a state where it feels impossible at this point to win as a Republican. But when I asked you, you know, is Raul Garcia just the mainstream's like, that's our guy? Mm-hmm. Part of the reason I think they're like that is he's more moderate. Mm-hmm. And Republicans who have been more moderate in the past have performed better than a Lauren Culp, who performed very poorly in King County. And so I think the prevailing wisdom is if you're not a moderate, you certainly don't have a chance in hell.
Yeah, I love that. And I'm going to change the word, not prevailing wisdom,
okay,
but prevailing thought process or prevailing mindset. And so, in fact, I have a different story, right, than even Raul or Lauren Culp. I'm the kid born in the ghetto of East Oakland, California, to a single woman with seven children, right? I was raised in Washington State, Seattle. So mom moved us to Seattle when I was seven. I dropped out of high school in Seattle, right? And so my story is different than any other candidate that has been put forth to run for governor in the state of Washington. Certainly on the Republican side, we're already making history. And so I think my message of unity, my message of overcoming adversity, that's a big difference from what Lauren's message was and typically what the Republican message is. I'm an old school Republican. I'm an Abraham Lincoln, Frederick Douglass, women's rights, civil rights. That's me. And so because I've lived that life, I think my background and my life's journey makes me relatable to people who said, yeah, that's me. I struggled. I overcame adversity. And so I want that for everybody to achieve that American dream.
Yeah. And at the same time, you've described yourself as, and forgive me if I'm misquoting, but a constitutional Christian conservative.
Yeah.
Now, look, you take all those words apart. I don't think any of them are particularly bad. Constitution, love it. Christian, just fine. Conservative. I share some conservative values, but you bundle them together and it scares the hell out of Seattle voters.
That's exactly it. No, you're right. As a matter of fact, Jace Rand said that, you know, and he says, well, there goes the Seattle voters.
Right.
And I give more credit to the Seattle voters because, again, I was raised in Seattle. I used to ride my bicycle down in downtown back in the day when it was safe to do so. And so, no, I give more credit to Seattle voters to say, just as you said, to separate apart. What is conservative to me? Conservative to me is valuing parents' rights. Mm-hmm. Conservative to me is believing that you can pull yourself up from your bootstraps and succeed in America. Conservative to me is focusing education on the students and student outcomes versus the ideological interventions that many try to bring in. So that's what I mean by conservative values.
Yeah. Have you considered how you're going to combat the narrative from Democrats? I mean, I think state Democrats have been incredibly disingenuous in their political ads. I see what they did to Tiffany Smiley. And I don't know that honesty is high on the priority list when it comes to winning elections in ads. So how are you going to combat that? They're going to paint you as the next Lauren Culp.
Yeah. So truth and facts and evidence. And so the truth and facts of it, again, I'm the kid who started out life without civil rights.
Yeah.
And so you cannot take my life away.
How old are you?
I'm 62 years young. I've always wanted to say that. But no, I started off, again, without civil rights. And now I'm financially, independently, just fine. Mm-hmm. Right? And so that's through hard work and prayer, not helplessness and despair. And I want that for all citizens of Washington State. So when they bring their stuff and they'll do maybe the Larry Elder thing, you know, and the talking face of, and you know, that's where that Christian comes in to say, well, bless your heart. Let's talk about my life on food stamps. Let's talk about my life getting food in a little brown packaging. Let's talk about getting grants from a Christian school so that we can attend, right? The kindness and graciousness of others. Let's talk about me serving in combat and reenlisting in a combat zone so that I get tax-free money that I can invest on my own. Or getting out there at 3 o'clock in the morning to paint a room of a house that I purchased and I'm remodeling so I can sell to reinvest. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Nothing given, everything earned. That is the American dream. And I want that for everyone.
Yeah. Well, so you're black, right?
Yes.
I don't know. I think you're black. For you, how do I put this artfully? Do you see that as a qualification for the job?
No and yes. So, and that's a terrible answer, and I get this.
Well, it's kind of it's an unartful question.
Right? No, so
that's where you are.
We'll work it out.
Okay.
You know, I told someone the other day, I said, I was born black, I was raised black, and I'll die black. And that's God's gift to me, right? I mean, that's just God makes us how God makes us, and I'm good with it. It's never been anything negative for me, even during the times of racism, right? The 60s, goodness gracious, right?
During times of racism, being black wasn't a negative for you?
Right? No. Well, because my mom. My mom raised me to have resiliency, right? She raised me to understand my self-worth, to have self-esteem, to have self-respect. Again, resiliency, so that I could actually navigate the adversities, right? Or barriers that life will throw at you, or as people will sometimes call systems today. And I have a whole discussion on that. But no, it gives me a context of understanding what it is like. That is unique. Mm-hmm. Right. If you haven't lived it, you haven't lived it. Yeah. So it's a little difficult to understand if you haven't lived it. I have lived it. And so I'm not the person who would ever say racism doesn't exist or that prejudice doesn't exist, because it happens every day, not necessarily to me, but different to different people. And I value that. I mean, I value that for them. But what I'm here to do is bring solutions, right, to remove those barriers, to look for opportunities and ways to elevate all citizens of Washington State, especially those who are disparately impacted or those who have been deemed marginalized. We need to reform our welfare system, right? We have to stop just giving people enough money to keep them poor for the rest of their life, or that becomes generational poverty. We can do better. We will do better. I'll do better. And so I think my race doesn't qualify me by no means. I think it's also representative of the greatness of America, back to those conservative values that anyone can make it in America if you're willing to work hard, even with barriers that may be there. I'm not going to deny it.
So again, that's part of my conversation with Semi Byrd, a candidate for governor of Washington. If you want to watch the full thing today, you can do that by becoming a subscriber to the show, undividedpod.com. That's undividedpod.com. Our Sunday with Subscribers show is exclusive for subscribers, but as I said, it's only fair that when we interview a candidate that we make sure that that interview can reach as many voters as possible. So we will lift the paywall on Tuesday. However, if you'd like to support the show, please do that so we can continue to bring those important interviews. One thing that just broke, news that just broke, that I got to slip in here because it's relevant. The Seattle Times reporting that the chair of the Washington Republican Party, Caleb Heimlich, is stepping down, which will be effective August 12th, which is interesting because he was just reelected to that position. But it sounds like he's going to move on to different opportunities. The Seattle Times reporting that he sent an email just a little bit ago to folks within the party, to GOP officials, saying after 12 and a half years working at the state, Washington State Republican Party, it is time for a change. It has been a tremendous honor to serve as the chairman of this great organization for 5.5 years. But for the sake of my family, it's time to pass the torch to someone new. He said he's going to go on to work for a national grassroots organization. Again, the resignation effective 12th, and then a replacement for the chair of the state Republican Party would happen at a GOP committee meeting. Now, this is interesting, you know, because Republicans are in a really difficult place, and so maybe there is an opportunity for change in leadership to right the ship a little bit. I don't necessarily blame it on Caleb Heimlich, though, that Republicans are in a bad place. I blame it on former President Donald Trump just being kind of a death knell for Republicans in a blue state. And so it'll be interesting to see who they choose to replace him. But I thought that was relevant given that, you know, they're just starting up this important 2024 campaign cycle, and they will have the 2024 campaign with a new state Republican Party chair at the helm. So a little bit of breaking news for all of you. Okay, coming up in a moment, we're going to have a conversation with Snohomish County Executive Dave Summers. His brother recently died from a fentanyl overdose. And while all that's happening, of course, Snohomish County has this huge, as many places do, fentanyl crisis. And so we're going to talk about his brother's death and also how he's using that personal experience in his family to decide where millions of dollars in funding that came to the county and other counties across the state from the opioid manufacturer lawsuits, how they're going to utilize that to try to deal with the issues. So we'll talk about that coming up in a second. But first, if you're in the market to sell your home, reach out to our friend Wes Jones at Wes Jones & Associates. Him and his team have an innovative marketing strategy to try to make sure you get the best price for your home, which is what everybody wants at the end of the day, and that you are able to sell it with the fewest possible contingencies. Here's what Wes told us about what they can offer you.
We have programs in place to help you prep your home. We can help cover your repairs and even cosmetic upgrades, where you can pay for those at the, you know, at the closing table. We have a flexible commission structure. We have the absolute best marketing that you're going to find of any real estate agent. And there is a lot of programs and different things that we do that I go pretty in depth with on my website. So you can start by going to sellwithwest.com and go to the sell a house feature, and you can got to go under some of the different programs, you know, that we have to learn a little bit more. If you want to check out your home's value, just plug in your, you know, your address there. And if you want to book a consultation with me, just give me a, you know, just give me a call. My cell phone is there on the website, and you know, it's super low pressure. You know, I'm going to tell you the truth if this makes sense, you know, or it doesn't for you, and I'm going to treat you fairly.
And I bet he'd also tell you and give you honest advice not to paint your house a stupid color before you sell it. There's a house in my neighborhood for sale, and they decided to paint it. Terrible color. It's like black on top and then like this weird gray color on bottom. I'm like, why would you paint the top of it black? Anyway, I digress. I'm sure Wes Jones would definitely tell you not to do that. But anyway, as he said there, he's got his contact information on the website, and you can go there, figure out what the value of your home might be. But I think more than anything with Wes and the state of the market having been all over the place, he's just going to be able to give you honest advice about selling your home right now, what you can expect, and what you can do to increase the value of it and to increase the offers to make sure you get the best possible price. So go to sellwithwes.com, sellwithwes.com. A better way to sell your home. Okay, the following segment is brought to you in partnership with our friends over at Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. I'm proud to be an ambassador for Future 42, and in fact, I'm going to be up in Bellingham later this week for a Future 42 event, so I look forward to that. Nicole's neck of the woods, hometown. We have talked on the show before about one of the reasons why you're seeing an increase in gas prices in Washington State, and this should have come as no surprise. Because when Washington State passed a carbon tax, all the free market people and folks were warning, like, this is going to raise the cost of gas. Of course it is. Of course this is going to be passed on to consumers. And the state of Washington was like, well, no, it won't. It's not going to have, it's going to have just a tiny little impact, if at all. And they were totally gaslighting people because it was like, that just doesn't make any sense in the world. And then, of course, once January 1st hit, we saw the price of gas start to go up. And still, it seemed like the state was in denial, either in denial over it or intentionally lying to people and misleading people, which, let me just say this, even if you support the carbon tax, okay, even if you think the carbon tax is a great idea environmentally, etc., I think it's still bothersome that the state won't just own the consequences of it for people's pocketbooks. You know, if Jay Inslee thought carbon tax is important enough where I don't mind Washingtonians paying more for gas, and if he just said that from the beginning, just acknowledged it, I would have a lot more respect for that than them saying, we believe in the carbon tax and no, it's not going to raise the price of gas, when everyone knows it is, and it currently is, raising the price of gas. But the gaslighting and the secrecy, it goes even a step further. Our friend Todd Myers over at the Washington Policy Center, who has been on with us to talk about this very issue, he said, and he had this article, the headline, Ecology Quietly Scrubs the Gas Price Impacts of CO2 Tax from their webpage. And he noticed that in a passage where they had been downplaying what the impact of the carbon tax would be, they've actually quietly changed the language in a way that people might not notice, but in a way that it has a substantially different meaning. So I just want to compare the before and after that Todd Myers noticed, and bless his heart for noticing these things. At least somebody's watching it. So this is the passage before on the Ecology website. Ecology also analyzed potential effects of Washington's other major greenhouse gas policy, the Climate Commitment Act, accounting for the impacts of the Clean Fuel Standard. We found the potential impact on gas prices is expected to remain low, about 1 to 3% in 2023. So again, previously they were saying impact on gas prices may be between 1 to 3% in 2023. Now, listen to what they changed it to. Because it might not seem like a big deal, but it actually is. They said, we also analyzed potential effects of Washington's other major greenhouse gas policy, the Climate Commitment Act, accounting for the impacts of the Clean Fuel Standard. As businesses adapt to the new policy, we expect the overall economic impact of the cap and invest program to be 1 to 3%. Now let that sink in for a minute. Previously, they made it sound like the impact to gas prices would be 1 to 3%, which is negligible. But now they are saying the overall economic impact is 1 to 3%, which if you're talking about 1 to 3% of the economy, that's very significant, and it's much different than 1% to 3% impact on gas prices. So again, I go back to this, even if you support the carbon tax, we can't support the government gaslighting us, lying to us, manipulating us, especially when it comes to our pocketbook. It just shows such a disregard for the money you work hard for. It shows a disregard for families who really do have to budget in what they're going to be able to afford for gas to get to work, to bring their kids to school. And it just reminds me that the people who are pushing these policies, they've never been in a position where they stood at a gas pump and had to decide, how much money can I put in? Can I afford to put $5 or $10 in? Or do I just have to put a gallon of gas in? So I would just encourage, especially people who support the carbon tax, to really push the government to be honest about what the impacts are, to be honest about what the impacts are going to be to people's pocketbooks, and to own it, and to make the case for why those impacts justify, why the impacts that it's going to have for people financially, why the policy is still justifiable. And I don't think that's too much to ask of the government. All right, that segment was brought to you in partnership with our friends over at Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org and make sure to sign up for their newsletter. As I mentioned earlier, we actually taped this interview last week with Snohomish County Executive Dave Summers. I didn't realize this until I saw a story on it, but Dave's brother died recently, just a couple months ago, from a fentanyl overdose. And as someone who has a family member who died as a result of, you know, I think a lifetime of addiction and mental illness, you know, it really hits home. And I think there are more people who have someone close to them who has battled with addiction than maybe we know, because it's something that I don't know that, you know, it can be a little taboo to talk about, or you feel shame in it, which you shouldn't, because I think it's much more common than we know. But at the same time that, you know, he lost his brother, of course, as the county executive in Snohomish County, he's also trying to figure out, how do we deal with this fentanyl crisis that is, you know, at terrible levels on our streets and really all across the state of Washington. And one thing happening right now is counties across the state are getting some of the money that the state got as part of the opioid lawsuits. Remember, the opioid manufacturers were sued and states got a bunch of money, including our state. And so we had the Snohomish County executive on to talk not only about his brother's passing, but also about how the county plans to use those funds as they come in. Here's our conversation. Executive Summers, welcome to Undivided. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you, Brandy. Glad to be here.
So first, this is a personal issue for you. Are you willing to talk a little bit about your brother? And we're so sorry to hear about him.
Well, thank you. Yes, and absolutely would like to talk about it. I lost my kid brother to fentanyl in March, March 16th, to be exact. He was 12 years younger than I am. Was born into a household where my mom was kind of descending into pretty horrible alcoholism. And so I was a little older, kind of more formed, and I had actually my mom's folks lived up the street a block, real supportive, wonderful people. Alan was born kind of right into the middle of a pretty terrible situation. It was not pleasant at any time. My mom made life pretty miserable for all of us, but it affected him his whole life. He, as we know, early childhood trauma really decreases a person's chance for success, and he kind of struggled. He was a smart kid. He was funny, personable. People really liked him, but he kind of beat himself up a lot mentally. And, you know, later on, after being a teenager and later on, got into drugs. Since I've been talking about this, I've had people reach out to me thanking me that because they had a family or a friend or a close one that and have experienced the same thing. And there's a stigma about it. A lot of people say, well, it's these people's own fault. They're just weak, bad people. And that's not the case. These are folks that come to drugs through many, many pathways and affects really good families and they're good people. My brother was a really, really good person. He was, like I say, he was smart. He was funny, talented. He had a business for many years as a contractor and worked hard. And he was a good person, and I'm proud of the battle he waged. I'm so sad that he lost it. But I just wanted to get the story out there because it's happening all around us. It's happening at an increased rate, and we just need to talk about it.
Yeah, and destigmatize it. And, you know, I've talked to parents and had parents on the show who, you know, their kids died not even thinking they were taking fentanyl, bought something off of, you know, a social media from someone they didn't know. It had fentanyl in it and it killed them. And so you're absolutely right that it touches so many communities. So we're going to talk about this $1.4 million that the county is getting. But first, can you discuss, so we all know the lawsuits that happen against the opioid companies, and how is that being distributed? So the money that the state of Washington got from those lawsuits, can you explain the distribution process?
Well, significant portion is going to the state for state programs, and then a significant portion, and I don't have the numbers right off the top of my head, but it's coming out to communities, local governments that are really grappling with the flood of drugs that we have on our streets and have to provide the services. So that's the $1.4 million we've received for 2022. At the end of the day, with the current settlements, over the next 10, 12 years, we'll be getting $12 to $14 million total from that settlement. And so it's distributed both at the state level, but also to local communities to help provide services and other responses to the drug wave that's really hitting us.
So tell me how you're proposing to use this payment, $1.4 million, which, you know, any money is great. I wouldn't say it's a ton of money. And so what's the most effective way you think to use it?
So the 1.4 that we have right now, the priorities that I put forward to the county council in the short term are first to expand our what we call our first responder leave behind program, which really provides and makes sure that there's availability of naloxone, which is a treatment that can help somebody that's in the middle of seizures and overdoses can save their lives. So naloxone out to first responders and to the public, so it's widely available. First step is to save lives. And we'll also be putting money out as direct financial assistance to existing community-centered opioid response programs. So there's a number of providers that are dealing with this crisis on the street. So we're going to get money directly to them as quickly as possible. Then asking both the group and the council to think about longer term actions. One thing we think should be a priority is school-based education and prevention programs. You know, kids growing up today are going to be faced with this one way or another, whether it's through their friends or their families. These street drugs and lethal street drugs are really a way of life. And so we need to get information to kids and families early on so they know what they're dealing with. It's not a cure, but it's certainly hoping we are providing people with the information they need to hopefully make better decisions. So that's one aspect. And also we want to establish a mobile resource to provide medication and assisted treatment or counseling to people suffering. So establish really a mobile program that can go anywhere in the county to address the needs of folks that are battling with this.
Yeah, I like the education aspect, as long as it's age appropriate, obviously, but it's something I've heard from parents who've had kids die, you know, who got something on TikTok as they like, we need to talk about this in the school. So I think that's great. And it's preventative, you know, on the naloxone front. I'm not one of those people who's like, oh, let them die, obviously. And I'm in full support of law enforcement and members of the public having that. I've interviewed people who they got, you know, their overdose reversed and went on to become productive members of society. And that was kind of their wake up call, which is like, wow, I almost died. What, though, in the moment, is there anything the county can do or is doing where if you have a firefighter or a police officer who administers a dose of that drug and brings someone back from the brink of death, is it just like, okay, now go about your life, or is there an intervention moment there? Is there an efforting of an intervention?
Yeah, we don't do anything that's just kind of one stop, like administer naloxone or provide shelter for somebody without also providing services. And this is something that I mentioned, we're going to be making sure dollars are getting to existing programs. We also need the state to step up in terms of providing mental health and substance abuse services. We are underprovided. We have more demand than resources right now, but we need to grow that with these dollars that are coming from the settlement. So we very much, if we're saving a life, we need to make sure that we're following up and offering these people and their families assistance. And every individual is different. Some come to drugs through pain management. Some come through mental health issues. Others stumble into it, whether I think that's actually probably a minority that stumble into it for recreational use issues. But the end result or the end goal is to help them get on a path to a productive life and get them back on track. And so the entire program is designed to do that. I don't believe in just sheltering people or just administering naloxone and walking away. We've got to help people. Yeah. One of the difficulties in our country, though, is people can refuse. Our laws and our values are such that we don't have the ability to force somebody, but we can strongly encourage and make sure that those resources are there for them and hope they will take advantage of it.
Yeah, and to that end, and I kind of want to wrap up here, but this has been obviously a huge topic of conversation during the legislative session, the special session that I can't believe was even necessary. But so the Blake decision and where our viewers will be very familiar with all of this, where we got with that in terms of, you know, making sure that drug possession is still a crime, trying to balance compassion and accountability for what's happening in Snohomish County right now. Are you satisfied with the state law as it was passed in the special session?
Well, I think so. We do need law enforcement. We need common sense approaches to this whole problem. And yes, compassion, we need to come at everything with compassion. The state law, as I understand it, is finally passed, set drug possession and use, public use, as a gross misdemeanor. What that allows us to do is get people into the legal system where they can make some choices between programs to assist them or more traditional incarceration potentially or fines. You know, incarceration doesn't work any more than naloxone works unless you follow up with services to help people. You know, putting somebody in jail for a few days and putting them back out on the street doesn't solve anything. But I think for some folks, it can be a trigger to finally decide that they want to help and there's a better path for them. So that's my hope, that we have really both the compassion side and also some carrots and sticks, what have you. In the end of the day, it's all the tools need to be on the table for us, because this is a very complex problem. Individuals are very complex creatures, and I think the enforcement side helps. But again, common sense.
All right, Snohomish County Executive Dave Summers, we really appreciate your time, you sharing your personal story, and we'll look forward to seeing whether this plan is approved and what impact it has. So thanks for being on.
Oh, thank you so much, Brandy.
Yeah, my heart just goes out to the executive and to his family. It's just awful, but it shows you. I mean, it's not just people who are, you know, living in homeless camps on the side of Third Avenue who are dealing with substance abuse. As I mentioned to him, I've talked to parents whose kids have died, and you know, you can be otherwise, you know, have a life that's been semi-normal, you know, had a job, had a home, but the devastating impacts of it. So interesting to hear a little bit about what's going to happen with some of that opioid settlement money and what other counties are going to be able to do with it. I'm glad not everything is going to the state, because at least if you have different counties with a little bit of political will, they can do what they want with it, as opposed to it all being spent in a way that Seattle progressives want it spent. So I think that's interesting. Okay, we'll get to our segment Unbelievable next, which is absolutely wild. So our friend Ari Hoffman broke this story. Two principals, two elementary school principals, both of them in the North Shore School District, and they are married. So they're, okay, I just want you to understand this. Married man and a woman, They're both principals at two separate elementary schools in the same school district. And apparently they're also cocaine addicts. So this is Ari Hoffman's tweet. Cocaine principal, Seattle area principal, found high on cocaine with a loaded gun at a grocery store, put on leave. The wife, also a principal at an area school, was also put on leave as the couple's drug use was revealed, one would hope. Mm-hmm. But this is an absolutely unbelievable story. So the guy, Redmond police say they found this guy high on cocaine with a loaded gun at a QFC. And they got there because there were 911 calls about this dude being there. And apparently he seemed like he was, paranoid, which, you know, he's on cocaine. So I'm not really sure how someone acts on cocaine. But according to police, he had like a white powdered substance on his lips. What is the SNL skit that reminds me of? I can't remember the name of the SNL thing. And he had a loaded gun in his sweatshirt pocket. And then he told officers that his wife, who's the elementary principal at Moorlands, was in danger of potentially being trafficked. So
it
super
sounds
way.
Like he had like a paranoid. She actually wrote a letter to police officers wanting to get his gun taken away because he had his gun just thrown in his sweatshirt pocket, unsecure. And so she wrote this letter and admitted to the cocaine use and said he had paranoia that was being
worsened by using cocaine.
But that they had just started cocaine one time when they were on vacation and tried it.
About a year ago, and now it's escalated. So yeah, the judge issued an extreme risk protection order. So his firearms have been taken away, which I think, given the circumstances, is appropriate for the time being. Yes. But yeah, she writes in this letter that they went to see their primary care doctor on March 22nd. And quote, "The doctor told us we needed to stop the use of cocaine. And that at the next checkup, the doctor would do a full workup to check for anything else that could be causing the delusions." Oh, your doctor told you to stop using cocaine? Shock of the century. Let me see here. The district released a statement. This is from Como News. In a statement from the North Shore School District, a spokesperson said, "While the April 30th incident didn't take place on a district campus or while performing district duties, North Shore immediately placed the first school administrator on leave to conduct an internal investigation." You don't say. Oh, he would have had to be doing cocaine with a gun at school. Right. Like, of course, your outside actions as a principal matter. They went on to say the second school administrator was placed on leave when additional information was added to the police report and the district became aware. In both situations, family and staff at each school were informed when the school administrator was placed on leave. The district will continue investigating, blah, blah, blah. And this is what I hate. It's like, there's nothing to investigate.
Yeah.
They can never go back to an elementary school and be in charge of kids.
Right.
Ever again.
I am curious. I mean, I am not a cocaine user, and I'm not an expert
although
either.
Although those sunglasses, Nicole,
kind of make me look.
You look like a cocaine user.
But I don't think that's normal behavior, even on cocaine, to go into a grocery store, think your wife's being trafficked, and have a gun in your pocket. Like, I don't think that's normal behavior, regardless. So I think there should be a deeper investigation. How has this guy gotten to the position that he's in?
Yeah, I mean, what is normal behavior on cocaine?
Just, well, that's what I'm saying. But I think there's a lot of people that do cocaine.
Yeah.
But don't.
Well, maybe he was
also doing
something else, or maybe he had underlying mental health issues, et cetera, et cetera. But this is wild.
I think that's what the wife was trying to tell the doctor. Something else is going on, and we're doing cocaine.
Yeah. And also, by the way, we've suddenly started to do cocaine, even though we're both elementary school principals. Wild. But I think, you know, what's unbelievable about this, besides like the cocaine principals, and these are people who work with kids, it does bother me. And we hear this often when there's public employees who some sort of thing happens where it'll be like, oh, we can't explain anything further because it's a personnel matter. And that's what North Shore said. The district will continue investigating and take appropriate action. North Shore can't provide any additional information since this is a personnel matter. Like, are there laws that protect that? Because that's a public employee. We pay that person to be using cocaine while they're a principal at an elementary school. So I have an issue, I guess, with any public employee and an investigation being shielded behind personnel matters, then we got to wait until 6 months down the road, do some sort of public disclosure request to figure out what exactly happened. But again, it should just be, I hate the way the government is where it's like, I believe in due process, But the guy was found at a QFC with white powder around his lips and a gun in his sweatshirt pocket talking about his wife was going to be the victim of sex trafficking.
And his wife confirms he's doing cocaine.
They've been doing cocaine. I mean, there shouldn't be an internal investigation that until this person gets fired. Like, you can do an investigation. Yeah. But then you got to go. And we shouldn't be paying you a cent more. It's absolutely unbelievable. Okay, let me see here. Before we get to the newest GOP presidential hopefuls, and I'm curious what you guys think about these, we're going to also get to your comments coming up in a moment. But I've been talking about First Mark Insurance on the show. And, I mean, I assume that you guys work really hard for everything you have. I'm going to just go out on a limb and say that there's probably not a lot of people watching who are like generational wealth where you haven't had to work for anything. It was just handed to you. And if you work hard for what you have, it's really important to make sure it's properly protected. And I will say, Mike and I, before we did the First Mark Challenge, we were woefully underinsured. Thank God nothing happened. But you don't want to see everything you work for go away because you didn't have the proper insurance. So what First Mark will do, it costs you nothing. They will go through, they'll look at everything that you have insurance-wise right now, maybe things that you need to have insured that you don't. And then they'll go through, they'll search all the major carriers, and they'll come back with a proposal and a plan for what kind of insurance they think you need. Or they might even say, hey, the insurance you have is actually fine. Here's Dave Taylor. He's the CEO of First Mark.
We believe, and we say that we will help 100% of the people that we work with, okay? Now, that doesn't mean necessarily that 100% of the people we work with are going to become First Mark clients, but we believe that we will actually help 100% of the people, whether that be stay with your current carrier, but let's modify your coverage a bit so you're better protected, or ultimately, hopefully, come over to First Mark. We're going to put you with a different company and give you better coverage, right? So the challenge is really challenging individuals to give us an opportunity to prove that to them. That's really what the First Mark Challenge is.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, it's just such a great experience because I don't know about you, maybe you're smarter than I am, but whenever I went looking around at insurance, I'm like, what does that even mean? I don't even know what that means. I don't even know what that coverage means or what I'm getting for this. And so First Mark is an insurance broker. So they're doing all of that work for you, looking at all the plans, all the coverage, and then they come back and they help you make sense of it, and you don't pay First Mark anything. So to me, it really is a no-brainer. Mike and I got much better insurance for about the same price, and that's what we needed. We knew we were underinsured. So do the First Mark Challenge, firstmarkinsurance.com. That's firstmarkinsurance.com. Make sure to tell them that you heard about them on the Undivided podcast. Okay, really quickly, because we're going over time, let's dip outside of Washington State. The 2024 presidential hopefuls just keep adding up. Mike Pence, a former vice president, obviously under Donald Trump, launched his bid. And this isn't a surprise. It sounded like for some time that it was clear he had been thinking about it. Nicole, though, noticed the New York Times piece talking about Mike Pence's announcement. I'm sorry. Mike Pence formally enters 2024 race challenging Trump. The banner advertisement is for Planned Parenthood.
Of course it is.
Which, of course, Mike Pence is like very pro-life. Now, somebody said, Matt Gilbert said on Twitter, Nicole, that a lot of the times these ads are built on your history. Are you Googling no. Planned Parenthood?
No. I mean, I guess it's possible.
We did talk about
story
him last week.
Maybe it's grabbed something from that. Yeah. But no, I mean, I just thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. So Mike Pence is in. And then I also heard Chris Christie's going to run. Come on, Chris Christie. Nobody wants to vote for Chris Christie.
Nope. I think that has come and gone.
That has come and gone. And then I tend to think, I will be honest, I tend to think that a lot of this is to make money. I'm not going
to
say necessarily Chris Christie,
I mean,
and Mike Pence,
be, right?
But I think that there are a lot of campaign consultants, etc., that benefit financially from people running campaigns, especially a campaign on the level of the presidency. And maybe they get in their ear like, hey, you know, you might not win, but let's run a campaign and we can raise money and all that. It has to be because it's just absolutely absurd at this point. When you have people who enter a race like that who are not going to win. And
I wish they would just put their support behind somebody. It just makes so much more sense if they really cared about the country. So that, to me, is very telling of people that announce like this, because then I'm like, oh, you're more worried about you and your name recognition and things like that than you are maybe raising money than you are saying, hey, I think this person is better than this person for the country.
Yeah.
And when you know it's going to come down to those two.
I mean, certainly Mike Pence, I mean, he has gone through a lot in the last couple years, you know, from the whole hang Mike Pence thing of chanters outside the Capitol and him feeling like the president didn't do enough to protect him and his family were at risk and all of that. So I'm not saying that he doesn't legitimately think he has an important platform and position to run for the presidency. I just tend to think that, man, you got all these people who run and the field's going to be uber crowded, which I wonder, because I know that like the challengers for Biden, the DNC is like, nope, not even going to consider it. Not even RFK and Marianne Williamson, who are already polling double digits. Like, we're just not going to allow it. I wonder to what extent, because Republicans have sort of shied away from, they push back against the traditional debate models. So I wonder if that'll be the case this time.
Or if, again, we'll have 16 people up there.
Oh, the 16-person debates. Or when they had to split it into two groups.
Right.
Because it was just too many. So anyway, Mike Pence is in. And I asked you guys on the live chat today, does a Mike Pence presidency interest you at all? 19% said yes. 81% said no. No interest. Okay, before we move on to comments, I've been talking about Eastside Weight Loss Clinic, eastsideweightlossclinic.com. I've heard from so many of you who started since I began endorsing them in January and are already down 20 pounds, 30 pounds, 40 pounds, which I love hearing those stories, so keep sending them in. I am down 36 pounds on the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic plan. I'm just feeling so good. In fact, that's why I wore this outfit. If you're watching the live stream today, I hadn't worn this outfit in forever. It's very egregious. It's like in your face. It's a full body, like jungle.
It's very Margaritaville.
Jungle one suit with parrots on it and stuff. It hadn't fit me for a while. I saw it in my closet today. Vacation. I'm like, you know what? That fits my mood today.
I like
it. So I'm going to wear that today. But it just feels good to go into the closet and just like pick something. And I know it's going to look good because I just feel so much dang better. So if you want to check out Eastside Weight Loss Clinic and see if the program's right for you, I like it because there's no prepackaged meals. There's no strenuous workout routine. It's just learning how to eat better, how to eat healthier. I think it's really good for people who have put on some weight that they're not used to carrying around because you can really cut it quickly, as I did. I lost most of that in just 2 months. So check out EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. Schedule a free 15-minute virtual consultation with Dr. Ryan Coogan. And you could just be on your way. I mean, mid-July, looking great. Okay, let's get to some questions of your guys' questions, comments from the live stream today. Bob Larson, hi, Bob. Said, great talk at the Lincoln Day dinner, Brandy. Yeah, I posted, by the way, my speech at the Lincoln Day dinner as a podcast, if you'd like to listen to it. The topic was freedom. I'm going to actually address it in our closing sanity check today, but that is up for you. David says, Nicole, there's some comments about your face, I knew there would be. You don't have to come on camera. You can if you want. Okay. You got your sunglasses on, your cocaine sunglasses. David says, you should have done stitches immediately.
It's possible.
David, are you a doctor?
It's kind of, I mean, as I showed you, the time progression, when it first happened, it really didn't look as bad as it does now.
Yes, it did.
Well, it did, but it had stopped bleeding very quickly, and they say that to go get stitches if it keeps bleeding, and I don't know. It just, this was not expected when I first sent you that photo.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, I'll just ice it. It's going to be puffy, but it's going to be fine, and it got a little bit worse.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. And it'll be a couple weeks, so you're just going to have to. I told you I'd help you with some color-correcting makeup. I have really bad dark circles. I just always have. Mm-hmm. So I've become very good since I was on TV of hiding my dark circles.
I'm already doing
They're not that dark, though.
Butterfly band-aids. I know. It's going to go through all those nasty color changes. I know.
So bad. Lynn says, that looks painful, Nicole. Jansen said, you know you're supposed to catch the ball with your mitt, not your face.
The sun got in the way.
That's such a dad joke.
I know, it really is. But the sun was in the way. I had it right here, and then it just went, whoop.
Yeah, last second.
Oh,
and I know you're easily embarrassed, so I'm sure you were mortified.
I was like, let me play, I'll be fine, let me play. And then they're like, no, you have blood.
You're bleeding, so no thank you. On the increase in gas prices in the state, trying to hide the fact that, of course, it was going to increase gas prices, and now they have to acknowledge that actually it might be a hit of 1% to 3%. Economically, because remember, like, when gas prices go up, what else goes up? Cost of your food and shipping things, everything that requires gas to function goes up. So it's ridiculous, the efforts to underplay it. Burton says, the carbon tax doesn't affect me because I make enough to overcome it, but most people can afford this. And you might make enough to overcome it. It still does affect you, though. It still is taking money out of your bank account. You just might not notice it as much as other people do. Gene says, it's not just gas prices. It is raising prices on everything, especially our food. So again, it's not just what you're paying at the pump. It's how do you, if you are operating your family's budget on narrow, thin margins, this is make or break stuff for you. And for the state to try to downplay that is it's not only offensive because they're treating you like you're stupid, it's kind of mean because it's like, yeah, I'm trying to budget. So you have all these people trying to budget for the increase on the gas prices for the carbon tax. And the state's like, oh, don't worry, it won't do anything.
Right. I was thinking that the gas prices haven't been making the news the way they did
yeah.
last year. And yeah. now it makes more sense because the rest of the country isn't seeing it where we are.
Yeah.
It is definitely more expensive in our state than most.
It is. And now you know why.
It's crazy.
Even if the state won't tell you. At least Todd Myers will tell you. And then when he tells you, we'll tell you what Todd Myers said because he's analyzing all of it. On Semi Bird's run for governor, I think Semi Bird's call to 911 was him making sure they know he's a taxpaying caller, not cheeky. So just so you know what that's referencing, if you didn't watch Sundays with Subscribers, I did play some 911 calls that Semi Bird had made that had a little couple alarm bells to me where he's talking about, oh, his house is worth $2 million. And I was like, it doesn't seem very humble. GL was saying that she thinks that's just his effort to tell them, like, hey, I'm a taxpayer. I'm not just like some person calling to complain. Julie said, thank you for doing the interview with Semi Bird. I've wanted to hear more from him. Matthew said, hi, Brandy. Do you plan to interview Seattle City Council candidates? Yeah, we do. I don't know how many of them will say yes, but we definitely plan to make a little pivot in the summer to the upcoming Seattle City Council races because I know a lot of you don't live in Seattle, but what happens in Seattle, we know, just finds its little tentacles everywhere. And I think if we can have a huge shift in the Seattle City Council this year, it could be really, really helpful to the rest of the state and to what's happening in Olympia, et cetera. On the camp in Berrien, Casey says, I'm glad they cleared it, but I wouldn't take my dogs there for the simple reason that I would be afraid homeless activists would throw poisoned meat around the park. Oh, what? Oh, because it's becoming a dog park. That's what they wanted to clear it for, is so it can be used as a dog park. So I don't know. I don't know what the homeless activists will do. Final comments I want to read are on Reject 5599. So the effort, the referendum. Janelle says, it's not just for the kids now. This affects everyone across the country. Other kids from out of state can come here. And who do you think gets to pay for this? All of us taxpayers. Lieutenant Dan said, in my opinion, it would be better for this referendum to amend the 5599 bill rather than to repeal. While the concerns for parental rights are legitimate, this effort will be marked as the anti-trans referendum. And that's what they're going to do. Of course they're going to mark it as the anti-trans referendum. I was called transphobe for pushing back against 5599, but that's why it's so important that the signatures are overwhelming and that the vote is overwhelming. Because I think it's about, you paint it on the extremes on both ends. Like you have one side of this who are like, oh, they're trying to indoctrinate your kids and they're going to send them to these shelters and they're going to come back a different gender. And then you have the other side that's like, if you don't support this, then you hate trans kids and want trans kids to kill themselves. And the rest of us are just like, look, it was probably well-intentioned. They probably care about these kids, but this is not the way to go about it. It's not to cut parents out entirely and to hide their kids from them. So we need to make sure that this referendum is a rousing success, resounding success, because we need to show that we're not going to be distracted by these, comments from the fringes. We're going to look at this bill for what it is and send a clear message to the majority party in Olympia that we're not okay with this erosion of parental rights and this creeping intrusion in the home. So I'll just reiterate what I said earlier before I do my closing sanity check today. Reject5599.com. Reject5599.com. You can go there. You can figure out how you can sign it, how you can help gather signatures, how you can help the effort, where you can get papers like this one that I have. And I'll also reiterate what I said earlier. I'm looking to do 3, maybe 4 meet and greets across Western Washington. And these will be available to sign at those. And so if you have a bar, a brewery, or somewhere where we can gather and I can do a meet and greet and just dip by for a few hours one day, and if you're interested in that, and people can come to the meet and greet. They don't have to sign this, but this will be available if they would like to sign it, if they are so inclined. So reach out to us, undividedpod.com, and just use the contact feature and let us know, hey, yeah, I have a brewery at such and such, and we'd love to have you there. I would love to be there. Okay, let us get to our closing sanity check. So I mentioned on Friday, I delivered remarks to the Kitsap County Lincoln Day dinner, and I had talked previously on the show about how some people had told me I shouldn't go, that the party was too extreme, that there was going to be a January 6th-er, J6-er, who'd actually face charges for January 6th there, and that it might hurt my reputation. And I was like, nah, I don't care about my reputation anyway. But I delivered remarks about the theme of the evening, which is Let Freedom Light the Way. And I posted those on Patreon and Locals. You'll see the link. I also posted the written remarks, but I posted my remarks as a podcast. And one of the things I know people are talking a lot about is the fact that I acknowledge for the first time ever that I have a lot of shame and embarrassment about some of the stories I did early on in the pandemic. When I was at Fox 13 and some of the coverage I did of the pandemic and how I really lost sight of the importance of our freedoms and our liberty and how I encouraged other people to lose sight of those things as well. And I look back at that and I can forgive myself a little bit because it was just a different time in the pandemic and it was early on. But I also want to make sure and wanted to use the opportunity last Friday to let people know I do have embarrassment and I do have regret for some of that early coverage. And I think we just need to normalize that, you know, not only in the media, but I think just in life to look back at things and to say, yeah, like, I wish I had done that differently. I wish I hadn't vilified my friends. And I'm just speaking more generally. I wish I had pushed back harder against what the governor was doing. Or I wish I hadn't been so hard on my friends who just wanted to wear a mask and that was their personal decision and I made fun of them for it or whatever it is. And I think that in order to kind of move forward from that period of time, I think it's great for all of us to do a little introspection of how we treated people, how we handled the pandemic, what we were okay with and not okay with, and just be open and honest about it and be able to move forward and do better for the next pandemic. So I hope you take an opportunity to listen to those remarks or to read them if you prefer, and just think to yourself about, you know, is there anything that I would have done differently or said differently, or would I have treated people differently? And the next time a pandemic comes up, because it will, we can approach it in a much more sane way. All right, that has been it for today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. Aunt Nicole, we wish you a speedy recovery. You don't have to be on camera again if you don't want. Sorry about your face.
It's all right. It'll heal.
It will heal.
I'm confident.
We're here for you. You know, you just ice it. All right, we
you
will
won't
see
me
you.
On public much this week, though.
Yeah, Nicole will just be. If you see her with sunglasses and a hat on, just know I didn't do it. A softball did it. All right, that's it for today's episode. Again, thank you for being here. A special thank you to Undivided subscribers who help make this show possible. If you would like to become a subscriber, you can sign up at undividedpod.com. That's undividedpod.com, and you can support this show for as little as $5 a month over on Patreon or Locals. In the meantime, I will see all of you back on the live show at noon tomorrow.